Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today, a return visit, LaVoya. We've had very few two-time visitors here on Great Minds, is my dear friend. He's in Johannesburg as we speak, LaVoya Madasa. LaVoya and I came to know each other through the journey of Mandela the Musical from London and the Young Vic. We are now actively on the journey to open on Broadway and, of course, ultimately the West End and all over the world. But we are here today to talk about a very different subject, and that is his work as executive director of Reimagine South Africa, widely known as Reimagine SA. It's a fascinating project. It brings together a lot of real challenges and tries to find new pathways forward to meet those challenges. We're thrilled to get a chance to see you always, LaVoya, and to dive into your incredible work at Reimagine SA. So a hearty welcome.
Thank you very much, Matthew, for having me, and wonderful to be back. And also very proud to be the part of the people who get a second impact. So looking forward to our discussion today.
There you go. I guess we're going to call this the return of LaVoya Madasa. So give us the Reimagine SA origin story. Take us back to the beginning of your engagement, the beginning of the work. Let's hear the story.
So Reimagine SA is a public benefit organization that was founded in 2016. By Dr. Mampela Rambele and the late Dr. George Lindeke. And these were people we could consider elders in South Africa who essentially come from different sides of the South African spectrum in terms of their careers and how they'd gone to be the people that we've known them to be. So Dr. Mampela Rambele is one of the co-founders of the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, and essentially has also gone through her own journey as a medical doctor, come business person, and activist in South Africa. Dr. George Lindeke is a former member of, during his time in tenure, so he speaks a great deal about what he calls used to being a salesman for the apartheid government. So he was part of the office that was part of the foreign relations and the international relations on behalf of the apartheid government. And through his career then also was involved in the human resources in a number of different international institutions. The most recent before his retirement was at Eskom, responsible for the transition of Eskom, our national power supplier, integrating a lot of different people in the different racial categories within South Africa into the business, and essentially helping Eskom transition into the new South Africa. When they founded Reimagine South Africa, they spoke to three different pillars. The first being us coming into this new democratic dispensation, which they define as political settlement, and also the various different programs that have been trying to kickstart, catalyze, grow the South African economy, which they identify as political, as economic settlement. And they had a real appreciation about South Africa having never gone through what they call emotional settlement. How do different spheres of South Africa, given the inherited legacy, given the challenges that we've had since democratization, and how people then show up emotionally to those realities, depending on the various different things that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Having never had the space to ventilate what it means to come from different spheres of society and be expected to be part of this new rainbow nation and just hit the ground running, as if we don't have the history that we have as a nation that is on the tip of Africa, but also a nation that has gone through the very specific journey that we've gone through from colonialism into apartheid kind of dispensation. I joined Reimagine SA in 2018, and have essentially been at the helm of trying to make this idea of emotional settlement to the benefit and recognizing our democratic dispensation, and in a way that enhances the various different economic programs that South Africa has been trying to get off the ground. So in my journey in tenure, it has been in a relationship and trying to make real what it means to bring the preamble of our constitution to life, where all citizens are recognized and have the benefit and the protection under the rule of law, where all citizens in the space where we are working together to heal the divisions of the past and working in a way that we are freeing the, so improving the quality of life of all citizens and also locking their potential such that we as a nation can take our rightful place in the family nation. So looking at that summary, Reimagine Essay then has the very interesting role in various different spheres of society of trying to facilitate the kind of dialogue where people get to ventilate all the different intergenerational traumas that they carry and the either conscious or unconscious baggage they bring to the table when we're meant to engage and try to understand what it means to take, you know, our rightful role as citizens in trying to move the nation forward and making it real. How do you make it real? How do you make it practical, applicable in the various different spaces that we operate in? So that's been my role and my journey with the Imagine Citizens Training.
Okay, so let's dial back a little bit and just try to set the stage. South Africa's democracy is young, give or take 30 some odd years old. Your great-grandfather was released from prison in the early 90s. The democracy is new. One of the most bizarre things to me, Lavoyo, about where we are here in my country, in America, is I almost feel like your democracy, new as it is in some ways more stable at the moment than America's, which is very disconcerting, a topic for another day. A lot of the promise of democracy and of the end of apartheid has not been reached and fulfilled. And what it sounds like Reimagine Essay is doing is going back to some of those principles and trying to make a lot of those opportunities come to fruition, dealing with trauma and issues that we have looking backwards, looking to the present, and most importantly, I would think, looking to the future on how do we reimagine the country as a place where there are equal opportunities, there are education opportunities, small businesses can get help, and bridging the gap with what the government may not be doing that it should be. Is that a fair sort of assessment?
Yes, in a number of different ways, but I think that's probably the simplest and most direct way of capturing it. So definitely top line in our agenda. And also, I think what's most important that people take for granted is that what the apartheid system did was ingrain and entrench the idea of separation. So if you think of the Jim Crow laws in the South, think of that tenfold because it went on cultural lines within various different racial groups, language lines in terms of identity, such that it created a context where the primary identities that enjoyed any level of acceptance, celebration, acknowledgement were those that were of the Afrikaans-speaking community and the English-speaking. So even now, we speak about having 11 official languages, 12 with the sign language, but you cannot engage in any meaningful business outside of geographic location if you are not proficient in English or Afrikaans in this country. And this is part of the agenda of saying, as Reimagine Essay, how do we have the important conversations that help people understand what does that really mean when we talk about being a rainbow nation? Are all the colors of that rainbow nation celebrated? And do they find space in environments like the one that I'm sitting in? Can I bring my identity into the way that I work? So when filling in any official documents in South Africa, we are generally asked what is our preferred language of engagement. And we also then ask what is the language that we speak at home. So is our identity, is our being trapped in a space where when we come into these public environments, we're predominantly engaging in English or Afrikaans, if you have a command of the language, and our identity, our home language is contained within the confines of our house. So this is a very real conversation that then speaks to the intentionality around the solutions, the intentionality around inclusivity and what it means. Because what you then find is that the language of trade and business is English, and in very many spaces, Afrikaans. And if people want to be successful, it is, you know, just by default, you have to be proficient in those two languages. Now, if we want to be successful in a way that is celebrating the Rainbow Nation, what does it look like? How do we make space for all of these different cultures that are in South Africa, these languages, the richness in the languages and these identities come both into the space And I think it plays itself in a number of different ways when you look at it from what diversity and inclusion achieves on the other side. Right? When you have organizations, and I mean, there are very many different examples in the tech space where you have women-led institutions, and people generally attribute the success of the organizations to the end result of having a woman-led institution. And while I'm not by any means taking anything away from that reality, people aren't speaking about the work those institutions do in order to create an enabling environment where women-led institutions can be taken seriously both within, their contributions can be accepted as valuable, meaningful, if not more impactful than institutions led by men. But there is something that is to be said about creating that nurturing environment that allows for that to be a reality that is respected and taken seriously. And equally, if you were then to create a context at a community level, at an organizational level, and definitely at a national level, where everyone's identity, cultural background, the value add, the richness that comes from when people get to fully express themselves, that can then lead to a rainbow nation, again, as outlined in the preamble of our constitution, can take its rightful place in the League of Nations.
So a couple of years ago, early on, when we started coming to Johannesburg on our road to launch Advertising Week Africa, I had some very vivid memories of going to Center City in the Mabonang area and seeing young mixed race couples. And I smiled to myself, you know, reflecting on the relatively short amount of time that has passed. That would not have been possible in so many ways, at least publicly, not that long ago. And in so many ways, the country has come so far, but in so many ways, that trauma, and you've still got many, many generations who were born into apartheid, whose children were born into it, I imagine in some cases, whose grandchildren were born into it. And so I would think a healthy part of your work, healthy may not be the right word, a large part of your work is around looking back and evolving from what is still got to be tremendous trauma for a lot of people living in the country.
Definitely. And it plays itself out in different ways, right? I'll use the analogy of, especially because a lot of our work is sitting in the mining sector right now. If you look at many mining institutions, what is likely the dynamic is that the mining boss or the groups of people that have had the benefit of establishing and growing that mining enterprise is generationally speaking. And again, I'm using this as an analogy, so appreciate that the corporate structures have now come into place where it's far less nepotism than it was before. But in all reality, it's likely to look like the people who were part of starting their mining enterprise back in the early 1900s. And when you look at the labor base, it is very much the same as the many people who were part of being the labor base back. Now, to your point around the large quantity, or at least the portion of our work being in having those conversations, or at the very least dealing with unspoken dynamics that are compounded by that reality. So when we speak about, you know, democratic South Africa, yes, we're all able to go to the voting polls, and this is an election year. But has our ability to cast a vote led to any material difference in our daily lives? And to a large portion of our population, the answer is no. Not in any meaningful way. Generationally speaking, the people who have been in their families predominantly likely to be working underground doing the drilling, 5-6 generations later, it's that family just essentially replacing the labor. And these are the real conversations when we talk about, you know, global concepts of upward mobility, education resulting into better quality of life. Do those things necessarily translate the way that they're anticipated or theoretically spoken about? In very many cases, unfortunately not. They do. I'm not by any means dismissing the power and benefit of education and being educated. they do change the prospects of people succeeding. But of course, with the challenges that we have in South Africa and an economy that's not growing to absorb the population and the skill bases, we are very challenged that that dynamic isn't changing at a quick enough pace, which then also speaks with the ripple effect of the different challenges that we contend with in this country and how they, while we are now free to move in physically in terms of no longer having the restrictions, when you look at economically, it's not necessarily at the rate and the scale that we would have hoped this far into our democracy. This is not to say that great improvements, great strides have been made, both by private sector to try and change the reality that we find ourselves in, but the real crux of the matter and the essence isn't, from my personal perspective, being dealt with in any meaningful, sustainable way. And I think these are the conversations that need to be had, as uncomfortable as they are, especially because the work environment is the one example outside of sporting events and socializing that we have the biggest likelihood of people interacting across all these various different racial, cultural groups. And if we're not having those conversations, as much as people will then say keep, you know, socio-political conversations out of the corporate environment, if we're not having them there, where and when can we have them? And we are then also suspending a lot of the work that citizens can and should be doing. And we are redirecting it and making it the sole responsibility of politicians. And we all know the challenges that comes with. And we're also limiting that real conversation to a 5-year election cycle, which is also not sustainable or practical for intentional nation building or rebuilding for that matter.
So it sounds like Reimagine SA is playing a bridge role and playing an activist role in ensuring that conversations that need to take place that are not necessarily happening or could be tied to the election cycle are happening. Is that also a fair take?
Yes, that is the thrust. What we found ourselves working in is in environments where organizations are trying to change the relationships they have with various stakeholders. And that then becomes the entry point for these many different conversations. So we, in engaging, assess the strength or health of relationships or relations between different stakeholders. And in trying to identify what a change agenda can look like for that community of stakeholders or that grouping, we then unearth a lot of the different challenges that they either fear don't have a place to be ventilated, will not be taken seriously, or how that message, that concern, that challenge is articulated is not necessarily landing and or being heard by the different parties that need to be part of the conversation, such that people can then have a common understanding of what the challenges are, at the very least for that particular stakeholder grouping, if not that area, such that people can then be intentional about bringing the right quality of inclusivity so that people have different perspectives that are brought to the table, can have the right, again, quality of conversation in solutioning together. And it's to rebuild the spirit of collaboration, right? And not always have the usual suspects having the conversations and making the decisions.
It sounds a little bit like the early days of the labor movement in America, where workers were routinely taken advantage of. This was at a time when, you know, the majority of businesses in America were manufacturing related businesses. A lot of those businesses, of course, have gone overseas now. But unions came in to defend the rights of those workers, to ensure that they were treated fairly, that work conditions were not dangerous. You said something that was very powerful, which is if you really assess the day-to-day lives of workers in the mines in particular, pre-apartheid, post-apartheid, not that different. That's a very powerful statement, and that's a pretty big challenge that you are taking on there. Where are you in the journey? I know when we were last together, you had a big piece of work that had just been completed that you were very excited about. But can you tell us kind of where you are, and can we look at a future where the plight of those workers day to day is considerably better and more in keeping with what we would hope to see from a free democratic nation that is treating all the colors of the rainbow well and equally?
We're at very early stages, very early stages. We are maybe at the concept motivating stage. So we have a handful of champions within the organization we're working with that are responsible for the organization stakeholder relations on the one side and how it shows up to the responsibility of what they call social performance. And given the science behind mining, we are bringing a hard conversation into a head environment. So people who are very analytical, their work is very scientific, it has predictable cycles by and large, and we are working and saying, if you engage different enemies, engage openly and honestly to understand, you are likely to have the kind of enriching quality of conversation that will help you create the kind of environment, work environment, that will have your personnel show up in a way that empowers them, and in so doing brings value to the institution. So as you mentioned, we have laid some very good progress. We delivered a first step of a bigger body of work, but this now becomes the proof of concept that we are able to take to different parts of the business such that people can listen differently and hopefully integrate the way and approach of engagement that we are motivating, which is a process called the Lizana process, which is about inclusive dialogue that has created an open environment for all the kinds of issues that need to be dealt with, to be ventilated and engaged in a meaningful way such that when it gets to solutioning, people don't feel as though the environment was too impatient to address their concerns. And because and think in all honesty and being realistic, we are dealing with centuries of a particular modus operandi. So even 30 years into our democracy, let's appreciate that's a very short period of time to change things that were institutionally entrenched and systemically driven in an uninterrupted manner, if at least for 50 years. But I think on a global systemic level for centuries. So let's appreciate the drop in the ocean that our democracy is in the context of what we're trying to do. And also then appreciate that the various different schools of thought are by and large coming from the largely global extractive way of doing things. And what we're trying to reintroduce is at the least an African philosophy that says, let's sit and be equals and recognize that we're equals and engage in a way that we, even if we disagree, we do so respectfully and we appreciate and value the contribution of each member of, call it the circle, call it the community, such that we can then say, you know what, we've done what we ordinarily call the feasibility study. And it's a feasibility not of a predetermined end goal, but it's a feasibility of our ability to engage in a collaborative, inclusive way, such that we can have more enriching solutions that have almost a kaleidoscope or a collage of people's input, such that the picture, you know, when you take a step back and say, okay, we are starting to become this rainbow nation we've spoken about, you know, this beacon of hope that people have spoken about in terms of where we are and how we've gone about the journey into our domains.
Absolutely fascinating and really heavy stuff that you're dealing with, Lavoyo. Every time I'm with you, and even in our conversation now, you irradiate such a positive spirit. You're dealing with very heavy issues, people who have real challenges, trying to bridge real gaps that, as you referred to, there's a 30-year piece of this, but there's also a centuries-old piece of this, of behaviors that are deeply ingrained. How do you stay positive?
How do I stay positive? It's a very good question. I think it's in having very personal experiences that while I have had very challenging personal experience is also having very positive. So being able to take a step back and say, well, not everyone is single-minded about the way things currently are. Other people like yourself, open to engaging to understand and are always encouraging about the opportunity to do better and show up and make a meaningful contribution. I think having those types of people in my life and experiences in my life are encouraging. I think as a recent father of twins, I also need to be optimistic because the alternative is very bleak. And I think my responsibility as a parent is to try as much as I possibly can to make a dent in this future that would allow them to, you know, bloom and blossom into whatever their personalities and their talents allow them to be. So you need to be optimistic and positive if you appreciate that you're landscaping for that next generation to be able to do the work that it needs to do. My beautiful wife is very, very optimistic person. So I think that I have that support at home. My mother is also a very optimistic person. The work on community development and engagement is something that I watched her do in terms of the roles and responsibilities she's had both in the corporate sector and the entrepreneurial endeavors that she's been part of. And I'd say my grandfather, of course, is the global icon, but I think the network of elders have always been optimistic about just finding a space to be.
Amazing. And I guess to some degree, the family business here is maintaining a positive spirit and taking on difficult challenges, to say the least. So interesting, Lavoya. Can we shift gears a little and talk about the current state of Mandela the Musical?
Happiness.
So the cast album from the Young Vic production just came out a few weeks ago, recorded during the 11-week sold-out run in London. You and Nandy, your mom and the Borowski brothers working actively now to bring it to Broadway. Talk about what that journey feels like for you. And, you know, let's talk about where we think we're going with the show.
So there's a quote in The Long Walk to Freedom where my great-grandfather speaks about, after having climbed this mountain and taken a break, I look back and see how far and look forward to see that there are many more mountains to climb. And I'd say that's probably the best summary of where we're at with the musical, the journey. It has been, as my mother said, a very interesting 17-year journey for the brothers specifically, Greg and Sean, and close to a decade of our involvement in the project and getting it where it is now. What we have learned, we've learned a great deal from the run at the Young Vic. We've had criticism, some constructive, some destructive. But I think, if anything, it's feedback. It's feedback about people's readiness to receive a piece like the one that we are telling, the personal life story about the family component, the sacrifice, the commitment that needs to happen in order for people to do the work that my great-grandfather Madiba had been dedicating his life and his peers and fellow freedom fighters had dedicated their lives to, along with their families. Where we are right now is reviewing the work, integrating the various different inputs to try and, as you've mentioned, pave the way to getting the piece into the various different stages we believe it belongs. And then also reworking some of the music, seeing which part of the music still has, you know, it still delivers the message, which other pieces that we've had in the catalog that can either be integrated and what new pieces need to be written insofar as telling different parts of the story that help knit this very intricate fabric together. I think what the journey has been is an inevitable review of the team. And as you're aware, with the role that we play, Greg and Sean are very much at the helm and the drive of that work. I think they have, you know, they've got the finger in the pulse as to the different opportunity sets that we have and the partnerships that we maybe need to review and make sure that we work quite well to get the piece where it belongs. So it's very much a review phase and a rebuild phase. And I think the album and the journey at the Young Vic, a priceless milestone for the journey that we've been on. And if anything, it reinforces what we saw as a dream to have this kind of the story musicalized and put on the platforms that we are speaking about. So it's very much a rebuild, a regroup phase. And I think the team is doing, the executive team is doing a great deal of work trying to take on the feedback and not be deaf to the audiences and what they've got to say. And I think that's part of building an entertainment piece. Some people are going to love it, some people are going to hate it. But nonetheless, it gives you a sense of what the temperature is in the room and in the various different audiences that we hope to reach.
Great, great summary. And it's been a tremendous joy for Isla and I to get to know you and Coquisa, your mom, Nandy. We were all there on opening night, December 5th, 2022, at the Young Vic. It was an incredibly powerful, emotional night to get from the Young Vic, which is that cut right below Broadway in the West End. So very much top tier, but a cut right below that top tier takes a lot of work. And the show has already gotten a lot farther than most. You know, the degree of difficulty to mount a production at a place like the Young Vic, which in America would be equivalent to a place like the La Jolla Playhouse or the Steppenwolf in Chicago, the Alliance Theater in Atlanta. These are all major league sort of, I won't quite call them developmental theaters, but sort of, again, that cut right below Broadway is a tremendous achievement. And I know the brothers are working very, very hard to take that feedback, to retool it. I think there's some rewriting of the first act in particular to really set up the whole story a little bit more cohesively. And some of the other important characters that were with your great-grandfather, people like Walter Sisulu and Oliver Tambo and other leaders of the movement way back when. But it's exciting to be a passenger on the journey. And I get to see Greg and Sean, who are in New York now quite frequently. And it's a joy to be involved. And we can't wait for that opening night and the red carpet on Broadway whenever that moment arrives. And I'm sure that it will arrive. I'm sure you'll all be here and we will have quite a night of celebration.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. And I think, again, I always take a moment to reflect and wonder what the journey they had been on to try and liberate and afford us the freedoms that we currently have as the next generation of South Africans into this space. I always think about that first time meeting at your home and you graciously opening your home for a very light conversation. And to me, it's yes, I think in relation to the day-to-day work of putting a production together, definitely a passenger, but I can only imagine, and I always make the comparison of the leaders you've mentioned, my great-grandfather, Oliver Tambo, Walter Sisulu, and many, many others who had to go to various different people and say, here's this idea that I've got, what do you think? How can you help? And in this course, as we say, which is to say that I am truly grateful for your warm heart and how you embraced not only us in the story, but also the brothers, and appreciate the support that you've given us. And also, I think in thanking you, thank the many others that have part of this journey. So much.
Well, you never have to thank me. It's a privilege to get a chance to contribute and to be at the table with you and Nandy and with Greg and Sean and the whole team. And it's a wonderful team. I'm really glad we got a chance to talk deeply about what you're doing with Reimagine SA. It's absolutely fascinating. And I'm certain we'll have you back for a third go on Great Minds as your progress continues. Vitally important work, very heavy stuff. I think a little heavier than we usually talk about here, but very important. And the journey for Mandela the Musical continues, and we will be sure to keep checking in on that as well. Please send my best to Nandy and to Coquisa, and loved getting a chance to have you here on Great Minds again, La Boya. So thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.